going to continue in Mark chapter 9. It starts out with a botched exorcism.
A botched exorcism.
Interesting.
We recall Jesus and three of the disciples have gone up a mountain, experienced a taste of the full glory of the kingdom, and now they are descending. So in a scene that may be meant to echo Moses' first ascent and descent of Mount Sinai, where the people waiting for him to return lose faith, and they end up creating and worshiping a golden calf. The scene at the base of the mountain upon Jesus' return from the transfiguration is also kind of that of chaos and a failure of the remaining disciples to carry out the task that they should have been able to do.
Oh, so when they get back, there's chaos, like Moses encountered.
It is meant to, I think, evoke that scene.
Okay.
And so Jesus rebukes all of them, saying, "You faithless generation."
At the end of this next section?
Yeah, towards the beginning of this section.
Oh, okay.
So as moderns, we want to try to explain the science behind the spirit that torments the boy. But to do so misses the point. It really doesn't matter if the spirit is a neurological, another physiological defect, or if it's a demon.
In other words, if it's a mental health issue, a seizure, or an actual demon.
Really doesn't matter. The symptoms and the result are tragic for the boy, his father, and by implicit extension to the rest of his family. This narrative discusses faith. But whose faith and what is its nature? Is faith a prerequisite for healing? What does Jesus mean when he says, "All things are possible for the one who has faith"? The actual exorcism and its ending is also unusual. Jesus calls the spirit the mute and deaf spirit. And the boy, after the spirit leaves him, appears to be dead. But Jesus then takes his hand and raises him. Do these strange details have any significance? Finally, Jesus tells his disciples privately that throwing this kind of spirit out requires prayer. Does this mean that there are different types of spirits? Some that do require prayer, some that don't require prayer? Or is Jesus attempting to communicate something else here? This story can be subdivided into four parts. And beginning with the end of the first section and continuing through the second is a long dialogue between the father of the boy and Jesus. Although the person around whom the action centers in this story is the boy, it's the father who is key to the message Mark wants to communicate to his audience. The climax may be considered to be the father's famous statement about faith. I have faith. Help my lack of faith.
Or we sometimes hear, "I believe, help my unbelief."
Yeah.
That sounds more familiar to...
The traditional, more literal translations will use, "I believe, help my unbelief." But it really is more properly understood by faith.
Help my lack of faith.
Because the problem with the word belief is that it indicates a mental assent to some sort of set of knowledge.
Right, which is, in Christianity, often claimed to be the test by which you are one with God or not. That's okay, babe.
So the first part sets the scene. Chapter 9, verses 14 through 18. And when Jesus, Peter, James, and John came to the rest of the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and scribes arguing with them. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. And he asked them, "What are you arguing about with them?" And someone from the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought my son to you, for he has a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth and becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able."
Sounds like a seizure.
The first thing to note is that the father would not have brought the boy to Jesus' disciples if there hadn't been some kind of precedent of them being able to cast out demons.
Yeah.
And the crowd certainly expected the disciples to be able to do so. In chapter 3 and chapter 6, Jesus had sent out his disciples with the authority to cast out demons. Mm-hmm. And they came back doing
having
so,
done so.
Having done so. So, there's prior precedent to the disciples doing this.
Mm-hmm.
The surprise, then, is that they are not, in this instance, able to do so. What were the scribes and the disciples arguing about? There's no explicit mention of what exactly the topic of argument was. Mark describes it as they were arguing with the scribes about something. And Jesus comes down and asks them, "What were you arguing about?" The disciples never give a response. Instead, the response that Jesus does here comes from someone in the crowd that Mark mentions, who turns out to be the boy's father. So what is the argument? It seems to have revolved something around the inability of the disciples to cast out the demon.
It never says what they were arguing about.
But it was between scribes and the disciples.
It was between the scribes, which we should understood to be the religious gatekeepers, the ones who may have been sent from Jerusalem, from the temple,
to keep an eye on things.
To keep an eye on, to investigate Jesus.
I think it was an argument over whether or not the disciples followed properly the routine regimen or,
is
you know,
this the proper way of casting out a demon?
Right. Did they do it the way they were supposed to, or did they do it the way Jesus wants them to? And so I think the argument was is that they were... they were unfaithful to Christ because they didn't do what they were supposed to do his way, and they were also unfaithful to the way the scribes want it done. So they were stuck between a rock and a hard place because they didn't do it. They were, their toe was in the, they were trying to beat the band on both sides. They were
maybe trying to satisfy both sides, trying to do it
right
Jesus' way, and also trying to satisfy the scribes who are standing there watching them.
Maybe, yeah, something like that. Anyway, they had given up a little bit of their faith in Christ and tried a little bit of the maybe, and that's just what I
the approved procedure,
right?
it's
something like that.
Well, it's close.
Yeah.
The dispute undoubtedly concerned not only the failure of the disciples, but the more basic question concerning their authorization to attempt an exorcism. The father had appealed to the disciples to exercise the power known to belong to Jesus, because the principle basic to discipleship was that the messenger of a man is as the man himself. In Jesus' absence, the disciples stood in his place and were regarded as he is. It was therefore legitimate to expect that they possessed the power of their master.
So when it didn't happen...
And what is even more pointed is that Mark is writing this to Christians now, where Jesus is absent.
So
Jesus isn't there anymore.
So more than anything, it was not really a differences between scribes and Christ's way. It was more a difference between what Mark's been talking about our path with Christ is way harder than we think it is, and that the absence of Christ is going to make that path even more impossible, possibly, and that we will not possess that quote-unquote glory that Christ has shown while he was here. Like, we're not going to get the full strength of Christ when we follow in him or something like that.
No, I think what Mark is saying is trying to say is that Christians should have the exact same power that Jesus demonstrated.
But that they don't.
They don't, and the question is why?
Was it because of his absence?
No. His presence or absence, as we'll see, should make no difference.
Right.
What Mark is also saying here, possibly, is that in Jesus' absence, his disciples have the full authority of Christ and is the full representation of Christ in the world. So what the world sees in Christians ought to be the perfect representation of Christ.
Okay.
That's what they ought to see. Obviously, that is not the case.
No, that's not what we actually see in Christianity today. But the point being made here is that we can, that is available to us.
Yeah. So Mark is using what was commonly known then as the master-disciple relationship. We don't have that today.
Yeah.
So we don't understand that. But maybe a better relationship is between a head of state and his or her ambassador.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador, that makes sense.
An ambassador is supposed to put his or her own personal agenda aside.
Right, and be for their...
Whatever this person, the ambassador, does or say is supposed to represent perfectly the head of state that he or she is representing. And not only that, but he or she has the full power and authority to act in the name of the head. The crowd is greatly amazed at the sight of Jesus. Since Jesus had not yet done anything except come down from the mountain, other translations render it in ways that might explain it better, or at least in language that we find more acceptable. But
maybe he still glowed or something.
Such as, well, that's possible, alluding to Moses, but that may not be. That's probably not the case. Other translations use greatly awed or greatly excited about Jesus coming down. But amazed may be the most proper translations. Verse 15 can be read as a commentary from Mark rather than a direct description of the narrative. So verse 15 has the character of a marginal note presenting Mark's comment on the fact reported. In seeing Jesus, the people were astonished. What we've seen in the past in Mark's gospel, astonishment is not a good thing. It indicates an excitement, but not faith.
Right.
The astonishment of the crowd was occasioned by the presence of Jesus rather than by any particular aspect of the event, such as his unexpected arrival at a critical moment. In the Gospel, expressions of fear and astonishment serve to emphasize the revelatory content and Christological significance of many incidents. Okay. So, astonishment indicates something significant that the crowd sees, but maybe don't understand. Whatever the nature of this disease or possession, the result is that the boy suffers and the father with him. As far as Mark and the crowd are concerned, the source is demonic. Whether one accepts such a direct involvement of demons or not, the reality of the effects of sin are demonstrated in this boy. No reason is given as to the cause of the disciples' inability to cast out the demon, as far as the setting goes. So various reasons have been suggested. They, speaking of the disciples, undoubtedly tried in various ways to heal the boy, but they were inadequate to the resistance they encountered. They possessed the power of God only in personal faith. But during Jesus' absence, an attitude of unbelief and self-confidence based on past successes had exposed them to failure. So it may be possible to read into this that the disciples have become confident in their past experiences.
In their own abilities.
Or the reader is presented with the examples, on the one hand, of the unbelieving and bickering teachers of the law, representing the Jewish establishment's rejection of Jesus, and the powerless disciples, who also show a lack of faith.
So there was some conflict going on in that regard, then, those guys.
Probably.
Okay.
The ability to drive out the evil spirit is connected with the ability to believe. The Greek word pistio, here translated as believe, but also sometimes translated as have faith. Rather than a concern from knowledge, the word has to do with relationship, specifically the relationship between human beings and God. Jesus had a relationship with God that gives him the power to drive out the spirit. By contrast, the disciples do not. Perhaps because of their earlier success, they think that they do have confidence in God. Their inability to heal the boy bears witness that they do not. So we don't quite yet know why the disciples have been unable to cast out the spirit. The next part involves the dialogue with Jesus. And he, this is Jesus, now answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you?
Wow.
Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to him. And when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood. And it has often cast him into fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." And Jesus said to him, "If you can, all things are possible for one who believes." Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, "I believe, help my unbelief." Who is Jesus calling here a faithless generation? Is he calling the father faithless, the disciples, the scribes, the crowd, some combination, or is it all of them? Commentators have various thoughts. We already read a few where, you know, the disciples may have been lacking faith.
The faithless ones.
The teachers, the scribes arguing with the disciples, mm-hmm. may have been the faithless ones.
Mm-hmm. It would sound more like it'd be all of them, because you have the father asking for forgiveness for his unbelief, you know, and to help him to understand and believe more. I think, is more the answer to his help my unbelief.
It's, right.
I believe now, help my unbelief throughout and from now on, but sounds like everybody was having a little bit of a problem with their relationship.
Well, he says generation. That sounds to me like it's more than just one category of people.
So, various suggestions. I mentioned a couple. From this point on, the disciples are out of the picture altogether until the private scene in verse 28 in the house. Thus, the disciples' failure is not blamed on their lack of faith, but on the faithlessness of the Father and the crowd. They are the ones Jesus addresses as O faithless generation in verse 19.
Okay.
Or, the language used in Jesus' rebuke in verse 19, O unbelieving generation, is intentionally similar to the terms used to describe the unbelieving Pharisees in chapter 8, verse 12, and the persecutors of Jesus' followers in chapter 8, verse 38, showing that this episode urges the readers to follow Jesus completely and to avoid the unbelief typified by the teachers of the law. Or, Jesus' poignant cry of exasperation is an expression of weariness which is close to heartbreak. This is brought into sharp relief when his exclamation is seen to be a personal word addressed to the disciples who alone had failed at the crucial moment. Or, when Jesus calls the disciples, the crowd, and the scribes a faithless generation, is this reproach a judgment on the failure of the disciples to cast the spirit out of the child? Since the crowds and scribes are clearly included in the denunciation, is it possible that Jesus is not rebuking the disciples for their failure, but rather reprimanding the whole lot of them for their arguing? Perhaps Jesus' chastisement is not a rebuke of their failure per se, but their faithless and divisive response to failure. So a number of suggestions, some at odds with each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now these are all scholars who have looked at this and come up with different answers. The interesting one here, maybe the last one, where it's not necessarily the failure that is faithless, but the response to failure.
Right.
Uh-huh. They're bickering again.
And I guess when it comes down to it, you know, there may be no one right answer. That maybe they all are correct in some ways.
Some ways, but it sounds it's a more reasonable response to the whole outcome is that they're arguing and that the bickering be their only way past a successful mission. So success is their only way to believe. After that, they can't pick their pieces up and keep going.
When it doesn't happen, then they've got no answer.
Right. There's no faith after success. Uh-huh. Like, success is their only way to be faithful. Otherwise, they just believe that, oh, well, now we're going to fight over it or whatever, that it didn't happen, so now there's something wrong with it. But that's,
That actually really makes sense.
The humanity of Jesus, which is very prominent in all Mark and throughout the Mark and Gospel, again comes to the fore. Jesus sounds rather exasperated and perhaps even a little worried. He knows his time is getting shorter. And the understanding of the people, including and especially his disciples, seems as shallow as it was when he began to teach. The boy is brought to Jesus and immediately, one of Mark's favorite words, immediately the spirit, recognizing Jesus, sends the boy into convulsions. Instead of casting out the demon, Jesus continues to engage the father in dialogue. Why does Jesus do this rather than immediately curing the boy? During the dialogue, Jesus and we learn more about the suffering the boy has undergone. So what do we learn from this? What does this little bit tell us?
That that there's been an unbelief for a long period of time, or that there's been a suffering by the child for a long period of time, that he's been he's been tortured mercilessly in different ways to get rid of the demon.
By reducing the son to complete helplessness, the unclean spirit betrayed his malicious intent to destroy the child in his utter contempt for Jesus. Now, what is prominent in this part is the description that the father gives of the spirit trying to destroy the boy, to kill him in any way possible. This dialogue includes both the exhortation to faith and the details about the boy's condition, which serve to make it clear that this was a desperate need and that the power of evil was truly present. But the point of giving these details is to say that in just such a difficult situation, Jesus' followers are expected to trust in Christ and to deal with the need as he did. So, now Mark, again, writing for an audience that is a generation or two now removed from Jesus. What do you do when you are faced with literally
a lifetime of
not just hardships, but maybe death itself? What is your response?
When it seems that you failed.
When it seems like that the demons themselves are out to get you. Or your family. What is your response?
I believe. Help my unbelief.
Towards the end of the dialogue, the father reveals some skepticism about Jesus' ability. Perhaps his faith had been diminished by the inability of the disciples to cast out this demon, the spirit. Now, his words contain a concealed accusation against the powerlessness of the disciples, which has led him to doubt Jesus' ability to offer real assistance to his son. Now, the disciples are supposed to be agents of their master. Then does Jesus really have the power? Which... Now, this father's accusation may be a very real accusation that those seeing Christians make. Jesus seems to call the father out on his lack of faith. Questions the question, if you can. And then Jesus says, all things are possible for one who believes. So what does Jesus mean by that? Are all things possible? All things are going to be done? All things are possible.
So...
Some readers would take this phrase, all things are possible, meaning that if I believe...
Then I'll get the Ferrari.
Yeah, everything that I believe in faith, everything that I ask in faith will be done. Is that what Jesus means?
I don't think so.
This response makes it clear that to regard as conditional the possibility of the requested miracle is to be unbelieving.
Okay.
This story does not teach that if one has enough faith, one can cure epilepsy, or whatever it is. This story does not claim that those with enough faith will never have a debilitating condition in the first place, or if they do, they can will it away themselves. Rather, it teaches that people are safe and saved in the company of those who throw themselves at God's compassion. The everything that is possible in verse 23 does not convey that believing will magically produce anything one might desire, but rather means that Jesus' power is available by faith to meet any need that arises in the course of ministering in His name.
So the energy to take care of a person, the will to help them and to take compassion over them, that type of energy is possible, and that anything is possible is that you possibly could go through more hardship but have the strength to endure it more than anything.
Yeah. Some listeners may hear Jesus' statement, "All things can be done for the one who believes," and infer that unanswered prayers must result from lack of faith. Jesus says all things can be done, or all things are possible. But listeners know that, for inscrutable reasons, all things are not done. Sometimes healing does not occur. Sometimes prayer seems to go unanswered. The difficult reality is that belief, no matter how strong, and prayer, no matter how fervent, do not guarantee a particular outcome. Jesus is speaking about God's ability to do all things, but He is not speaking about
the believer's ability.
The fact that all outcomes will be done according to what a person wants.
The believer's thing will be the desired ones.
Yeah. I think the more adversity you face and realize that it's more your faith in God helping you get through it rather than make it all better is what is more important. Like our attitude toward failure, which is kind of what this is all setting up, is that it shouldn't be the devastation of our existence because we failed. It should be the opportunity to take the strength of God that He's given you to keep resilient, to go on from what you've done or what's happening to you, to continue moving forward. So, and a lot of that comes from like modern Christians nowadays are saying, "Well, give it to God," or things like that. But really, some of the things that I've heard lately is like, believing in God before you get in trouble gives you the strength when you are in trouble to deal with it. So instead of being like, "Oh my gosh, you know, God, get me out of this problem," it's like you already believe God is willing to help you with your problems. So when you get in them, your first reaction is "God's going to help me with this."
So for me, it goes back to the story of the fiery furnace. The three men said, "We know that He can bring us through this, but even if He does not, we still believe." And when they got inside the fiery furnace, the people looked in and saw four men there, and Jesus was standing with them. And even if they had died, the miracle still would have occurred, because the primary miracle was the fourth man in the fire. The fact that they walked out of the fire was secondary. Yes. And walking out of the fire is sometimes what we're looking for and assuming that when people say, "If you believe, it'll happen," then walking out of the fire is what they think is supposed to happen. But it's the fourth man in the fire that's the miracle, and is what He's saying is available to everyone.
Right, that's you're not alone in your suffering.
Yeah.
The Father's response to Jesus' challenge is the famous quote, "I believe, help my unbelief." Uh-huh. What should we make of this? What does it tell us about the nature of faith? It seems... Okay, it is contradictory. Uh-huh. No, I believe.
Yes.
Help my unbelief.
My unbelief.
His cry expresses humanity and distress at being asked to manifest radical faith when unbelief is the form of human existence. At the same time that he affirms his faith, he associates himself with the rebuke addressed to the disciples. This generation is always unbelieving. The ambivalence in his confession is a natural expression of anxiety in the earnest desire to see his son released, but it is also a candid plea for help at that point where his faith is ready to fail. The exchange between Jesus and the Father established the personal relationship necessary for the accomplishment of that release. The response of the Father allows us to explore the interplay of faith and doubt, belief and unbelief. While it is nice to imagine that we ourselves are full of faith and that our churches are filled with people who never experience doubt, the reality is that most of us have the tentative faith of this Father. Our faith begins with if. Yet this Father is celebrated for acknowledging the admixture of belief and doubt in his own life. Standing in front of Jesus with his own child suffering from possession by a spirit, this man is willing to announce both his belief and unbelief all at once, commingled.
Uh-huh. And when we can admit that we have both, then maybe that's where...
Yeah, so if... First thing is that
belief happens.
When this father finally had a personal relationship with Jesus, mm-hmm. he became able to express his doubt. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The other point to note, I think, is that sometimes, or maybe often, we either think or we're told that, you know, if in the presence of Jesus, all doubt will go away. Mm-hmm. Where this father...
And if it doesn't, then you're deficient in some way.
This father is in the presence of Jesus.
And still able to say that he doubts.
And he has doubt.
Yeah.
So maybe doubt isn't really as much of a problem. At least certain ways of expressing doubt is not nearly as much of a problem, or maybe it needs to be done.
Right.
In order for faith to happen.
To have it, well, to happen, but maybe for the faith to have the proper reaction inside of us for when we doubt and then come to realization that we are, that our faith will help us, it makes that faith more, it gives it more weight when we actually overcome our doubt. Or realize our doubt was misplaced.
Perfect faith is not required. The Father does not permit his doubt to paralyze him. Instead, he moves closer to Jesus. He acknowledges the limits of his own power and asks Jesus to do the rest. Jesus responds with compassion. Jesus may have rebuked his disciples and crowd, calling them a faithless generation, but he has no harsh words for the Father. As William Plaker observes, in our story, Jesus does not say to the Father, "Well, you'll have to try harder."
Right.
The Father having begged for faith, Jesus simply cures his son. So we take our fragile, half-broken faith to God, and in God's grace, it suffices.
I see. So a lot of the bickering and arguing was what was angering Christ at the time, but he was still able to keep his side of the bargain and be faithful to the Father and the Son whom needed him the most. He didn't make it better for the disciples because they failed. He didn't answer for the scribes so that they were right. He just simply took compassion on the two individuals that needed it when the other ones were too busy worrying about their own strife between each other.
And then the actual exorcism takes place. And when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit and saying to it, "You mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again." And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, "He is dead." But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. In a narrative oddity, Mark reports that a crowd is gathering.
So more
when,
than
when there dead. Already was a crowd gathered.
There was already a crowd, yeah. But now a crowd is gathered.
No one really knows why that is. You know, is it that more came, or is it that Jesus had taken the father and the boy away,
mm-hmm.
and that
the crowd
is now
followed?
Coming? But the maybe the point is that when Mark is emphasizing the point that Jesus sometimes has reason to avoid the crowd when he performs his healing works.
Right.
Uh-huh.
In response to the father's admission of faith and its lack, Jesus rebukes the unclean spirit. This word rebuke is the same word used when Peter tried to rebuke Jesus, and Jesus rebuked Peter in turn. In Jesus' rebuke, it is interesting that he calls the spirit the mute and deaf spirit, when the Father initially described it as a spirit that makes him mute. Perhaps Jesus' description is Mark's way of recalling an earlier narrative that involved muteness and deafness back in chapter 7.
Oh.
Jesus' rebuke is quite emphatic, commanding the unclean spirit to leave and to never return. So still desperate and still honest, the father cries out, "I believe, help my unbelief." To this request, Jesus immediately responds by exorcising the boy. This demonstrates three things. First, Jesus does have the faith for which nothing is impossible.
Yeah, it's Jesus' faith.
Second, inadequate faith on the part of either victim or advocate does not prevent miracles. And three, the answer to the father's prayer that Jesus help his unbelief is the miracle itself, which would certainly destroy any doubts the father had about Jesus' power. The portrait of the faith of this father invites listeners to a richer understanding of belief. In contemporary Christianity, belief is often understood as intellectual assent to a set of doctrines.
Okay.
In this story, however, the question is not whether the father can affirm a specific creed or statement, or whether he follows a particular faith community. In this story, belief is portrayed as a matter of trust. Trust in the power of God to transform situations that are hopeless by human standards.
Mm-hmm. Belief, a person actually believing firmly in God is clearly not the issue here. Both because the disciples were the ones who lacked belief originally, and Jesus had it, and because the man says, "Help my unbelief." It clearly presents belief and faith as much more nuanced than simple unwavering assertion to a particular fact. And it clearly says that the unwavering part is not a requirement for receiving the goodness from God. It's quite cool.
The result of the exorcism is so violent that immediately afterwards, the boy appears as one dead, so much so that those who saw were quite sure he was dead. But Jesus takes the boy by the hand to raise him up. The word used here, the word arose, is related to the word for resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's the same word.
So he resurrected him, basically, is what it's saying.
In chapter 9, verse 27, Mark says that the boy's convulsions left him in a condition looking like death, but that Jesus lifted him to his feet. Jesus' action foreshadows of his own victory over death in his resurrection, and symbolizes that the power of Jesus is this life-giving power.
Well, he looked like he was dead. It sounds like he was postictal. It sounds like he just had a seizure. Right after a seizure, looking like dead.
Mark's not making a medical statement. He's making a theological statement.
I know. And then he says that Jesus resurrected him.
That malicious action was repeated at the moment of exorcism with such violence that the boy took on the appearance of a corpse, so much so that most of the people said he was dead. The expression "became as one dead" implies that he was not dead, although there was clearly room for discussion concerning this. But the accumulation of the vocabulary of death and resurrection in verses 26 and 27 and the parallelism with the narrative of the raising of Jairus' daughter suggests that Mark wished to allude to a death and resurrection. The dethroning of Satan is always a reversal of death in an affirmation of life.
New life. The boy has new life.
There is a nuance in this instance, however, which must be appreciated. There appears to be a definite heightening of demonic resistance to Jesus, which can be traced in the sequence, chapter 1, verse 23 through 27, to chapter 5, verses 1 through 20, and then here, chapter 9, verses 14 through 29. So three exorcisms.
Becoming more difficult?
In the first instance, it was quite easy. Second instance, a little more difficult. In this third instance, the disciples are powerless before the demon's tenacious grip upon the child, and Jesus is successful only by the costly means of death and resuscitation. The healing of the possessed boy thus points beyond itself to the necessity of Jesus' own death and resurrection before Satan's power can be definitively broken.
I see. Satan, or the forces of evil, are gaining power, and Jesus must ultimately defeat them
by succumbing to him and then raising again after.
Wow, that's cool.
The last two verses act as an epilogue. And when he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, "Why could we not cast it out?" And he said to them, "This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer."
Yeah, why this kind?
Mark gives the answer to why the disciples were unable to cast out the demon. They didn't pray. Well, but we're still left wondering what exactly that means. A withdrawal to a house where Jesus may be questioned in private by the disciples is recorded in chapters 4, verse 10, 7, verse 17, chapter 9, verse 28, and chapter 10, verse 10. And on each occasion, these conversations provide supplementary teaching reserved for the disciples alone. In the house, Jesus emphasizes the theological point of an incident. In this instance, the final conversation relates to the central theme of the unit. For the epilogue qualifies the faith of verse 23 as the faith that prays. So it's faith that prays. So what is this prayer?
She saw the cat rock.
Whose faith and what kind of prayer?
Oh.
Is it the one doing the casting out? The one asking for it? The one who is afflicted?
The one who's doing the casting.
Commentaries offer, again, various possibilities.
Again, I'm going to go with all of the above.
Since the Markan Jesus has not prayed in this particular story, this must be a reference to the necessity of a regular practice of prayer. The disciples' power for ministry depends upon the quality of their time spent in the presence of God.
Oh, he didn't pray.
Jesus didn't pray at all here.
He said only prayer works, even though he didn't pray.
All the way at the beginning of the gospel, in chapter 1, verse 36, Simon, and those with him pursue Jesus out to his place of private prayer. Demonstrating that they have little or no patience with someone who merely prays when there is so much to do.
Uh-huh.
This may reflect...
So this is an object lesson.
This may reflect a problem in the Markan community that the evangelist addresses using the disciples as bad examples. If the Christian community lacks spiritual power, the problem may be an overemphasis on action to the neglect of prayer.
Uh-huh.
So that's number one. Second commentary here. The dialogue between Jesus and the father of the demoniac boy in chapter 9, verses 23 and 24 provides an object lesson for Mark's readers on the importance of strong faith in Jesus. This function is verified by the final and climactic word in 9, verse 29, that prayer is the means for Jesus' followers to acquire the faith and resources to conduct the required mission.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Three, in response to the inevitable question of why they had failed, Jesus explained to the disciples that such malign spirits can be expelled only by a full reliance upon the unlimited power of God expressed through prayer. This response contains at least the implicit criticism that the disciples had failed because they had not acted in prayer and sincere faith. The disciples had been tempted to believe that the gift they had received from Jesus was in their control and could be exercised at their disposal. This was a subtle form of unbelief, for it encouraged them to trust in themselves rather than in God. They had to learn that their previous success in expelling demons provided no guarantee of continued power. Rather, the power of God must be asked for on each occasion in radical reliance upon His ability alone. Number four. The prayer in this story comes on the lips of the stricken boy's father, who prays for faith in words that Mark's readers of every generation have used in their own paradoxical moments of simultaneously believing and not believing. I believe. Help my unbelief. Whatever faith this man needs for himself or for his son comes not from the depths of his own being, but from the God who answers prayers like this and who gives faith and trust to frightened souls and doubting hearts. And five, when Jesus' disciples question him privately about the reason for their failure to cast out the spirit, he explains this kind can come out only through prayer. Indeed, the Father's plea to Jesus for healing is much like a prayer. Of course, Jesus' response to the disciples does not mean that if only they had remembered to pray first, then they could have expelled the demon. Prayer does not function as a magic formula, always yielding the desired result.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. That really makes sense.
So the suggestions as to what exactly Jesus might have meant are numerous. Come all the way from disciples failing to maintain a faith relationship, a trusting relationship, and dependence upon God, to maybe the fact that the Father needed to express His own faith and its lack before help could come. Before we leave the text here, of tangential interest is that some manuscripts add "and fasting" at the end of verse 29. So, prayer and fasting.
Yeah. Okay. Some manuscripts include the fasting and some don't.
The stress that prayer alone is efficacious, however, is striking because in Judaism, the recitation of the Shema and of Psalms 3 and 91 was considered a powerful agent against evil spirits. In the early church, the efficacy of fasting was championed, and this emphasis has left its mark upon almost the entire manuscript tradition of verse 29. So, for example, the King James, based on the Latin Vulgate, which was based on later manuscripts, includes prayer and fasting. But in more recent times, when earlier manuscripts have been discovered and examined, it doesn't mention the fasting. It's just the prayer. A few final thoughts before leaving the story. This child's possession in many ways reflects the difficult situations and evil circumstances faced by disciples of Jesus who long to make a difference. His circumstance also invites us to consider the many injustices and oppressions people face in our communities and around the globe. Symbolically, the child's suffering could stand for other forms of injustice and oppression, and so remind us to pay particular attention to the varied injustices that affect children disproportionately, such as hunger, war, discrimination, modern-day slavery, and sexual exploitation.
And that is something that we as a society can actually affect.
To read this story as simply talking about some kind of physical ailment, which it seems to be, when looked at from modern medical science, or strictly a spiritual problem, such as a demonic possession,
or faith,
is to narrow, is to misinterpret, is to forego the broader applications that are possible.
That under all of our squabbling and our worry of faith and everything, there's still the need for our children to be watched over more than all of that. Like, to the disproportionate plight of the youngest of our generation being left or suffering without us really being able to do anything about it or not seeing anything, any need for it to be done.
If Jesus came to restore society. Restoring society means looking out for those who do not have power.
Right.
For the weak, for the oppressed, who have no voice in the way things affect them. And children, for much of the world, really is. No, they have no voice. So who is going to stand up to be the voice of the children?
Or the powerless in society. Maybe that is part of what Mark is talking about.
If the church lives as the continuation of the incarnation, the body of Christ on earth, then it will not keep safe distances from injustice by only making pronouncements, signing petitions, and lobbying for legislation. The church will take victims by the hand and build relationships. Might it be that the failure to do this, the failure to touch the child, was the beginning of the disciples' inability to cast out the spirit?
So they were afraid to touch him because they might catch what he had?
Maybe.
I mean, in a way, or they just didn't have the compassion to hold
him? They were afraid to identify with the child and his father. They wanted to simply display their power and go. And didn't want to actually become part of the situation.
Jesus clearly is depicted here as making a relationship happen with the Father. And then of actually reaching out to touch the child. Prayer points us back to the God who is the source of all power and all healing. Prayer is an expression of faith, giving voice to our dependence on God and our need for God. In prayer, we cease looking at ourselves and look instead to God. In this, the Father proves himself a model of faithful discipleship. And his story brings good news to those who struggle to believe. Faltering, fumbling faith is enough, for God carries us the rest of the way. So maybe what this story is showing is that this father is a better example of discipleship than the disciples. This incident brings us back down from the glorious height of the transfiguration experience to the earthly sphere where the power of evil is confronted and where unbelief is a constant danger. In the same way that the disciples are brought back into Jesus' earthly mission here after transfiguration that prefigures and symbolizes Jesus' resurrection, so Mark's readers were to realize that they, after the resurrection of Christ, were called still to an earthly mission of faith and of proclamation of Christ against the forces of evil. This exorcism, the last one mentioned in Mark, shows the power of Jesus portrayed in the Transfiguration in action in practical terms and means that it is in such ministry and not in visionary experiences that Christ's power and glory are properly to be seen in the life of his followers.
It's in helping the powerless and acknowledging the gray scale that is faith, that Christ is more effectively recognized than in the shining glory that we're looking for.